It's Thursday, November 18, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The article in yesterday's edition of USA Today is certain to get a good deal of attention. It has to do with a pastor in New Jersey who has called for his church members to get out of social media, and most directly, to get off of Facebook. Why? Well, as he tells the story, it's because this new engagement with social media is leading to a very real danger of infidelity. The pastor is Cedric Miller. He serves as pastor of the Living Word Christian Fellowship in Neptune, New Jersey. I think we can understand his logic. As his local paper reported, and now USA Today communicates to the larger culture, this pastor has found that several of his church members have reconnected by means of social media with old flames, with high school romances, with college sweethearts. And as is so often the case, this kind of relationship begins to build independent of the marriage, and before long, it can lead to infidelity, an alienation of affection, if not to outright adultery. Now, I think most of us looking at this might think that this pastor has simply gone too far. Almost every new communications revolution has brought new opportunities for sin. And when it comes to sexual sin, it's hard to top the revolution that came with the telephone, or for that matter, with the automobile. Both of those technologies greatly facilitated the opportunity of persons to commit sexual sin, to arrange clandestine rendezvous, to have communications outside the reach of a spouse. But these concerns did not keep even persons who would be concerned about an outbreak of adultery from using them, from making use of the telephone, and of course of the automobile. The corrective in all this is not just to throw out the technology. As much as I am sympathetic with this pastor's sense of desperation, I'm just trying to save marriages and families, he says, and I'm certain that is his aim. But you know, when it comes to social media, a far better way to deal with it is to make certain that it is not the private endeavor that so many people want it and make it to be. For instance, in a marriage, there's no reason why the spouses should not have full access to each other's Facebook accounts and should not take full opportunity to see exactly what's going on in the Facebook lives of each other. That should be a part of their marriage if indeed they're going to engage in social media, not something extraneous from it. There should be no embarrassment in it. Quite frankly, my wife knows more about my Facebook account than I do, and she helps me a great deal by keeping up with it when I can't. It's something of a team endeavor, and I think that's the way it ought to be with spouses. To have independent lives is to risk not only an alienation of affection, but a breakdown of the marriage. When it comes to social media, there is enormous power here to draw persons together. But Christians, it better be those who know that it ought to be the right people getting together for the right reasons on the right terms. That means open communication. That means nothing hidden between spouses. That means no digital life that is separated from actual life. And that means learning to have the same kind of disciplines with digital media that we have with other technologies. Yes, including the phone, including the automobile. The technology is not the problem, even though the technology affords new opportunities for sin. The technology is not the problem, even though the technology itself makes demands upon us, including moral demands. It's the user of the technology that in the end is responsible, and it is the user of the technology that must take responsibility before indeed danger enters. For those who are unwilling to take such precautions and to arrange such responsible boundaries, I say take this pastor's advice. Get off of Facebook. Get out of social media altogether. Get rid of your laptop. Get rid of your phone. Don't even drive your car. It's simply not worth it. While we're on the topic of marriage, I just have to mention a major article that ran in the Los Angeles Times. Harriet Ryan reports that sex addiction rehabilitation is becoming a thriving industry. In one sense, you almost knew this was going to happen. Now, here is the way that the scare line on the headline reads. Celebrity sex scandals have helped fuel mainstream demand for treatment of sex addiction, though it has yet to be officially acknowledged as a disorder and is not under government regulation. Now, that's a rather fascinating and, eccentric way to describe the problem, but Harriet Ryan is onto something here. This new business of sex addiction rehab is certainly a sign of the times. Just consider what the cultural reflex was when the scandal broke out concerning golfer Tiger Woods. Well, if indeed he is guilty of this kind of infidelity, it must be because he's something of a sex addict. It must be a problem that has been foisted upon him, and there must be some kind of therapeutic solution. Once there is the call for a therapeutic solution, well, you can count on the fact that someone will be there in order to arrange the therapy and to charge you for it in the process. Now, one of the points made by Harriet Ryan in all of this is that there is no particular science. There's not even an agreed-upon definition of terms here. What we see is the reflection of a therapeutic culture, a culture that believes that when sin or this kind of issue erupts, it's not a matter of someone doing what is wrong. It's a matter of someone acting in a way that they need therapy to escape. It's a pattern of addictive behavior. Now, there are some very real addictions. Physiologists and medical doctors can point to a physiological basis for some forms of physical addiction. But when it comes to moral behaviors, it's fascinating to see just how quickly a fallen culture leaps upon the idea of addiction as a way of evading moral responsibility. It's not only a way of evading that responsibility, it's a way of suggesting that the way out of it is some form of therapy. Now just consider for a moment what we're talking about here. How in the world does a secular culture that denies any kind of objective sexual morality come up with even a baseline norm for what sexual health is supposed to be? Does it mean no sex outside of marriage? Well, of course not. It means something they'll define as responsible sexual behavior. This is the same kind of culture that comes up with the idea of safe sex, as if the only issue in sex is hygiene, either not getting pregnant or not catching a disease. This is a mentality that spreads far beyond sex, but with the intimacy of sex in human lives, well, this hits right at ground zero, where moral culpability and now cultural availability come together in this kind of a sex industry. It's a thriving industry. As Harriet Ryan reports, it's becoming a multi-million dollar industry. She writes about such businesses as the Center for Healthy Sex, where, since 1997, a therapist there once began with only a handful of colleagues, but now says that this is a booming for-profit field. Hold that for-profit thought for just a moment. In the meantime, know that this therapist speaks of celebrities, saying, "Celebrities have been the greatest evangelists for treatment. Quote, my practice wouldn't exist without them," end quote. And now we arrive at another level of cultural complication, because now it becomes, in our celebrity culture, the end thing, the almost desired thing, the new kind of bragging rights that one is involved in some kind of sex addiction that needs some kind of sex therapy, and that one is going to the new and trendiest and most popular sex therapist and undergoing the latest therapeutic treatment. You see where all of this goes. There's another aspect to it as well. If there's a burgeoning industry, you can count on the fact that others are going to be elbowing their way into it. Before long, there'll be debates about just how many people are in need of this therapy. Already in this article, there's the suggestion that as many as 5% of all Americans are in need of sex addiction rehabilitation. But already in this article, there are those who are saying, no, the real need has to be much larger than that. That's the way it works. That's the way the therapeutic industry perpetuates itself. That's the way a moral evasion captures cultural energy. And before long, a burgeoning industry is a sign of a collapsing morality. And there you have it, in a nutshell. In an article in the Los Angeles Times on the burgeoning industry of sex addiction rehabilitation. Christians know one thing for sure. Rehabilitation is never enough. It was about a year ago that National Geographic magazine noted the story, the virtual evacuation of Christians from the land of Christianity's birth and the entire Middle East. Now, in the aftermath of the massacre of Christians in Baghdad, Iraq, most major world media are paying some attention to the fact that Christians are beginning to flee Iraq. Since the Allied invasion of Iraq in 2002, the numbers of Christians in Iraq have been depleted. And given the threats to the Christian population there, we can almost count on the population being further depleted until it is almost completely exiled and evacuated. But it's not just Iraq. It's not just Afghanistan. It's not just any one nation. It's the entire region. In much of the Muslim-dominated world, Christianity is outright outlawed. But even in places where it's not outlawed, it is coming under such cultural pressure that Christians are now feeling the burden to leave. This is true even on the West Bank and in the Palestinian territories, where many American Christians fail to understand that a good many of those Palestinians have historically been, and are even now, believing Christians. This is a complex situation. There's more to it here than mere religion. There's more to it here than mere geopolitics. This is a situation that has evolved and developed with twists and turns and horrors and tragedies over centuries. But it should not go without the notice of Christians, and Christians in America in particular, that in the lands that are so much a matter of our geopolitical concern, even in lands where there is so much American investment, Christians are becoming an outright endangered species. The Christians in this country are not to let that pass without our prayer, our concern, and to do what it is that we can do so that it is not so dangerous for our brothers and sisters in this part of the world. Finally, in the New York Times, Jane Brody writes about something that I found very interesting. It seems that in the personal health column, she writes about how physicians are conceding authority for treatment decisions to patients. This means that patients are now becoming far more a member of the team for their own treatment. They're taking on new responsibility and new authority in making these treatment decisions, especially where quality of life issues come to the fore. Now, when you think about this for a moment, this tells us something about a cultural transformation going on before our eyes. Just a few months ago, a book came out demonstrating that in the lives of most communities, at some point, there was a shift from the pastor to the medical doctor, from the pastor to the physician, in terms of the one who was considered the authoritative expert in the community. But now, even the doctor is losing that exalted status of the recognized expert, because in the age of Google and Wikipedia and all the rest, patients come armed with a great deal of information and data, some of which puts them perhaps even ahead of their physician when it comes to minute areas of knowledge and at least their own self-diagnosis and their own quest for medical treatment. Now, this particular article by Jane Brady suggests that this is a long-term trend. The shift in authority from medical decision-making, from mere doctors telling you what's going to happen to you, to decisions being made in collaboration between physicians and patients and family members, well, this represents something of a massive cultural change. But it's not just going on in medicine. This is the way the world has been going, the direction of the culture for some time. The devolution of authority from the regime of experts to the actual population is something that the professions have fought, but is nonetheless happening. I found the closing statement by Dr. Jackson Rayner, professor of psychology at Georgia Southern University, to be very interesting. He writes, "These days, patients have to be their own best advocates, well-schooled on symptoms, disease states, and treatment options, and use their physicians as colleagues. This can be quite a challenge for patients who still defer to their physicians. But it's no longer in a patient's best interest to say to the physician, you know what's best." End quote. Well, it's a statement like that that makes me wonder just how far in this direction a trend can go. After all, this is a professor of psychology cited in this article, speaking about physicians. I've got my doubts about how many physicians actually think themselves to be the colleagues of their patients. We'll see. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I'm coming to you today from Atlanta, Georgia, where I'm here for the annual meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society. Over the next couple of days, I'll tell you something about what's going on here, as evangelical theologians and biblical scholars are discussing and debating some of the crucial issues of the day. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.